Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Wednesday, March 20, 2019. IMF warns South Sudan will have to struggle with its loan. And Oxfam is warning that there are loopholes in South Sudan's laws that allow forced marriages to continue. We'll have details on these stories right after this. A South Sudanese activist, Peter Bier Ajak, is scheduled to appear in court tomorrow. Ajak was arrested in July at Juba International Airport when he was trying to board a flight to Awil. Another South Sudanese businessman, who has been also arrested by the National Security, will be arraigned in court tomorrow. We now go live to Jok Madu Jok, the founder of SAD Institute, to explain to us about justice in South Sudan. Jok, welcome to South Sudan in Focus.
Thank you very much, Mr. Tanza. I appreciate it.
Yeah, bring us up to speed. There is a press release by the South Sudan Civil Society Forum calling on the government in Juba to accord Peter Bier and Carbino a fair trial. What's going on?
What is going on is that this is a step that we are now told will take place tomorrow. Was supposed to take place 24 hours after their arrest because these gentlemen have never been accused of any crime and they have never been brought in front of court, in front of the judge. Even their arrest was not supervised by the judicial authorities as the law and the constitution of South Sudan dictates. So their arrest has been completely unprocedural. Their detention for going to 8 months now and 10 months in the case of Carabino Wolago has all been completely unconstitutional.
And if you are telling me that this is unconstitutional, is South Sudan having a constitution?
Well, South Sudan has a constitution and all those rights are spelled out. Rights which would have prohibited this gentleman to be detained without trial for this long. But there is a twist to it, and that is the introduction of national security law following the outbreak of 2013 civil war in South Sudan. And that national security law is a kind of emergency law that has given security authorities the right to arrest without any judicial supervision. And all the civil society activists and all the citizens groups have been opposed to this idea, but that law was still able to make it through our parliament and has become the law of the land now. I think that is the law that they use to arrest these gentlemen and detain them this long. And all of it is also unconstitutional because a national emergency law of that kind was not even put through a regular procedures that would have overridden the constitution of the land.
I've been following high-profile cases in South Sudan, and mostly people are sentenced, and then after 2-3 months, you hear the president pardons them, gives them an amnesty, and they are back to life. I can give you the case of the former detainees who were accused of a coup, and the court dismissed the case, and they were released. There was the case of the former spokesman of Dr. Riek Machar and the South African former colonel who were sentenced to death, and they were pardoned. What is your reading on this latest high-profile case of Peter Bier, Carbino, and the others who were in Blue House?
Well, I mean, all of that, of course, is felt ominous. Process for our country when, in fact, when the executive interferes with the law such that instead of people going through the judicial process, such that people, instead of going through the trial, which should be accessible to the public, these people are detained indefinitely, and then the president issues an amnesty as a way to use justice to seek political alliances and to interfere. The executive is constantly interfering in the judicial processes which is a total violation of the Constitution. Yes, the president has the power to pardon people, but not every single detainee in the country should rely on the goodwill of the president. It should, everybody has the right to rely on the legal system or the justice system to accord them the rights.
Legal experts have long since been saying that the judiciary in South Sudan is not independent. What is your assessment of the judiciary in the country?
The, many cases like the ones you have enumerated, the trial of the political detainees, the trial of those civil servants who were arrested for loss of money in the office of the president, and many others, thousands of cases of this kind, where people would be detained and then instead of the legal process and the judiciary going through them and the public being able to witness it, these people usually end up being released without the charges being pinned on them, without the legal process going through, the due course of the law doesn't take place. For example, what will take place tomorrow, we are not sure whether Peter Biara Jack and Karbino Wola Gog and many others that will come before the judge tomorrow, whether they will be even allowed to have the legal defense defend them. And if they don't, then we will know for sure that the justice system in our country is not free and it's not fair. And if it is left to the whims of the president and other political leaders to make decisions on whether people should be detained or should be released.
Let's talk about the charges labeled against Karbino and Peter Bier. Do you know any charges that were brought against them?
Initially, when they were arrested, they were never charged, at least not publicly. Nothing, the national security that detained them in Blue House or any other judicial bodies in the country didn't know what these people were being detained for. And because of that, an incident occurred in the detention place where they were being held, where they protested in jail for being held without charges. And demanded that they be presented before the before a competent court, and because of that protest, now the charges have that they are being arraigned for tomorrow are charges that were levied against them because of that protest, including use of guns, including these other criminal acts that they have supposedly committed while in detention, when in fact what they were doing, they were protesting their illegal detention.
And so, looking at these new charges brought on them, I mean, it sounds a little bit weird here that you are charged for speaking out for your rights. Now, what is the end game? I mean, I fail to understand the end game here on what will happen tomorrow. Why are they even brought out tomorrow? Because it looks like they have been judged before the trial starts.
I think it is the national security trying to save face, that instead of just let them go after so many months in jail, I think they're trying to act as if there has been a procedural legal system that has gone through their cases, and that is why the charges are being brought now, and eventually these cases will be dropped. This is my reading of the situation, except, of course, we are not sure whether the accusation of treason that is now being pinned on Peter Biara Jack, whether it will continue to be presented in court or not, or whether the court and the trial will just focus on the crimes allegedly committed while in detention, we do not know. But if the charges of treason and publishing false information against the state, all of these, if they are maintained as the basis for trying Peter Biara Jack, then, of course, the whole public will now see whether this will be a test to the judicial system in the country.
But, I mean, ordinary South Sudanese could be wondering and asking this question. For how long are South Sudanese going to allow their justice system to operate in this way? Today, it could be Peter Biara Jack and Karbino. Tomorrow, it will be Jok Madud Jok. And next tomorrow, it will be somebody. What are you people doing to ensure that the court is independent, the judiciary is independent?
Yeah, I think, as you know, governments are never good to their citizens on their own account. Citizens have to demand the state to do right by them, including
sorry about that.
Including protesting some of these things vocally and more loudly. And the problem is that the state has been very, very heavy-handed and draconian to the point that where citizens are not able to table their grievances in a on a public platform and demand that the government lives by the land, by the laws of the land. So I think it will take more concerted civic action for the state to be able to do right by the citizens. That space is not there.
Well, joke, I'll...
Joke,
I will allow you to take some water and just treat your throat. We will come back to you. Just hold on the line.
Thank you.
World Health Organization is launching an oral drug regimen. It says can more effectively treat people with multi-drug-resistant tuberculosis. In advance of this year's World TB Day, March 24th, the WHO is issuing a call to action to eradicate the disease by 2030. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
Tuberculosis has plagued humans for thousands of years and continues to do so. TB remains the world's deadliest infectious disease, killing nearly 4,500 people a day and newly infecting 10 million people a year. Despite the grim statistics, much progress has been made in the diagnosis, prevention, and treatment of the disease. The World Health Organization says 54 million lives have been saved since 2000. But the WHO warns the gains risk being lost with the emergence of multidrug-resistant TB, or MDR-TB. The current treatment for MDR-TB involves a 2-year treatment course of painful injections, which provoke many bad side effects. The WHO says it is hopeful the new oral treatment program it is launching will be more effective in controlling the spread of the particularly virulent form of tuberculosis. The director of the WHO's global TB program, Teresa Kasayeva, tells VOA the new oral drug treatment the WHO is recommending has far fewer adverse side effects.
Of course, it will be definitely much, much easier, and there will not be need for regular frequent visits of the physicians or health workers for making these injections. No doubt, and again, we see from the data, the effectiveness, the treatment success will be definitely much, much higher.
The South African government has announced it plans to adopt the injection-free treatment. Kasayeva says the cost of the oral treatment is around $2,000, which is largely unaffordable for low-income countries. She says South Africa is engaging in talks with pharmaceutical companies to drop the price to $400. The WHO says South Africa is one of the 20 countries most affected by MDR-TB. Others include Russia, China, India, Nigeria, Pakistan, and Vietnam. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Child and forced marriages are illegal in South Sudan, but a civil society activist says there is loopholes in the law that allow families to go forward with the practice. Ayen Dengbior has details from Washington.
The Transitional Constitution of 2011 guarantees women and girls the right to consent to marriage. The 2008 Penal Code penalizes husbands who marry young brides. The Child Act of 2008 protects children from torture and abuse, including freedom from sexual abuse and exploitation. At first glance, South Sudan has laws designed to protect women and children from child, early, and forced marriage, according to civil society activist Jacqueline Nasiwa.
When you look at Article 1 of the Constitution, it says South Sudan is founded on justice, respect to human rights, equality, and fundamental freedom. So when you talk of human rights, it means the rights of women and the rights of children as well. And then Article 6 of the Constitution says that marriage is by free will of all the parties.
But a closer look at the laws reveal contradictions that could provide loopholes for families pursuing a marriage by force, says Nasiwa. For example, the Child Act defines a child as someone who is below the age of 18, but the Constitution is less clear about the age, according to Nasiwa, an ambiguity that she believes is problematic and contradictory to the protections afforded by the Constitution itself.
So we have Article 15 that says every person of marriageable age, and that marriage has to be done according to the customs and tradition. So looking at that article of the Constitution, marriageable age is vague, it's not defined, and when you consider our customs, marriage is done when even a child could be maybe 12 years. We have girls who are married at the age of 12 years below 18. So having that definition in the Constitution, which is the supreme law of the land, so calling for marriageable age, I think does not protect the child.
Article 17 of the Constitution is supposed to protect children, saying that all children should not be subjected to exploitation, abuse, negative and harmful customs that affect their dignity and welfare. It also gives the state the obligation to protect vulnerable children and orphans. But there is a gray area that doesn't define who a child is. Oxfam wrote in a report last month that in some parts of South Sudan, high rates of child, early, and forced marriage, quote, take place in a context in which women and girls face threats to their rights and well-being throughout their lives, end quote. The South Sudan government, through its Ministry of Gender, Child, and Social Welfare, has asserted its commitment to protect women and children. It established safe centers for psychosocial support, according to Oxfam. The ministry also launched a gender action plan called the Strategic National Action Plan that aims to eradicate child marriage by 2030. As lawmakers and politicians continue to implement the peace agreement and make plans for a revitalized transitional government, Nasiwa says they should take a close look at the laws of the land.
We may need to review the transitional constitution, particularly amending Article 5 that gives a general interpretation to customary law to be part of all sorts of legislation.
She says eliminate jargon that allows perpetrators to use traditions and customs as an excuse to break the law.
And here I'm looking at the transitional constitution. When you look at Article 1, it says South Sudan legislations are founded on customary practices and traditions. So minding of the customs and traditions that are negative on the rights of women and also doesn't protect the child, you could see that the constitution is contradicting the protection that I highlighted earlier on.
Nasiwa adds, there is not enough advocacy in South Sudan to ensure women and children know their rights. And she says that also needs to change. Ayen Dangbior, VOA News, Washington.
If you have just joined us, we have Jok Madud Jok live from Syracuse. Jok is the founder of SAD Institute, a think tank in South Sudan. Jok, you just listened to this piece by Ayen Bior. It's still talking about legal issues, that there are laws on paper, but its implementation is the problem.
That is correct. In fact, much of the negative experiences that citizens of South Sudan go through with the legal system of South Sudan are to do with the failure to implement the text and the spirit of the law. And of course, as it was also mentioned, there is a gray area between where the customary practices, which are the source of law in South Sudan according to the constitution, where they leave off and where the national constitution takes off. So that gray area is really part of the problem, that women and children continue to be victims of the malpractices and malapplication of the law. With regards to all the other civic rights, it is really a flagrant violation of the written text of the law. By all the various security agencies, and other agencies of the government. The detention of the people that we're talking about is really simply a malapplication of the law. Otherwise, people cannot stay in detention for more than 24 hours before being presented in front of a competent judge.
And how would you react to the statement from the government that they are doing all this in the name of, you know, the preserving the national integrity of South Sudan?
No, I mean, if the constitution of the land is the nucleus, is the document around which all citizens rally as members of a community, as citizens of a nation and not citizens in their tribes, then the government definitely by saying that these abuses are in the protection of the country completely contradicts the very idea that somebody is a citizen in a nation. And if the only thing that a citizen gets is to be abused by the state, why should that citizen be considered, even consider themselves part of that entity called South Sudan?
Well, Jock Madudjok, will leave it at that. Thank you very much for joining us from Syracuse, New York.
Thank you.
That was Jock Madudjok, the founder of SAD Institute, a think tank in South Sudan. You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, four wildlife traffickers are arrested in Africa. Find out where when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
what is your favorite game and how is it played?
Cricket. There's a batsman and the bowler. The bowler throws the ball to the batsman and the batsman tries to hit the ball as far as possible.
Yeah, actually, the favorite game, I like it. Eh? I like kickboxing, but when I was in Sudan there, my dream is just to be a big kickboxer. That's what I like. Yes, it's not about just to kick people, eh? Just because I think it's just a game, eh? But I like it. Because me, I like something, can enjoy the play. It's just a game, yeah.
My favorite game is chess. How it is played is we have a chessboard where pieces are set. It is now two kingdoms fighting against each other.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The South Sudan government has taken out loans which it promises to pay with proceeds from future oil revenues. According to a new International Monetary Fund report, economic conditions will worsen in the fiscal year 2018-2019 as South Sudan struggles to service the loans, prompting many observers to question why South Sudan is borrowing huge amount of money at this time. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
In a report released March 18th after discussions with government leaders, the International Monetary Fund staff team leader Jan Mikkelsen says the resumption of hostilities in July 2016 affected the economy, leading to a substantial loss of income, high inflation, foreign exchange shortages and acute deterioration in humanitarian conditions. Mikkelsen says the conflict has led to the loss of fiscal discipline and weakening of public institutions, leaving the country in a deep economic crisis. He strongly advised the government to stop taking out more loans based on future oil revenues. Economist Marielle Awol, who is also the vice-chancellor of Upper Nile University, says he agrees with the IMF that the government should stop oil advances.
We are borrowed when we need resources, so the lenders dictate us on their own terms. So definitely paying back this money will be a big concern and a big, you know, commitment to undergo. So we need resources. On the other hand, we have a huge demand for resources which we cannot meet. So it is a very expensive business.
Awol says he believes the government wants more cash on hand because Juba is in the process of implementing the revitalized peace deal. He says cantoning, training and transforming the army to a national army may require more money. He says appointing more ministers also costs more money.
We are going to have 35 ministers in this country and a number of deputy ministers in this country, and all of them need resources. So the government is desperate because we don't have any other alternative source of income except oil. They have been going around, you know, mobilizing resources. from the friends, international friends, from the region, from UN, you name it. All of them are not ready and willing to extend even a penny to the government.
Ahmed Morgan, another Juba-based economist, says the IMF's appeal has not come at the right time because of the peace deal. Morgan says oil advances have both advantages and disadvantages.
If you have those advances and they are not put to proper use, okay, in terms of development, again, development will suffer. But again, it has got the advantages currently. It's the government needs money, and that is a major source. And there's a deficit in the budget. Then it has no option but to take loans in order to run its daily projects.
Morgan says the IMF report gives a gloomy picture of South Sudan's future. He says the government should consider reorganizing the revenue system to ensure money collected from non-oil revenue goes to the government and not individual pockets.
It's going to be very hard because depending on oil is not the best thing an economy could do. You know, now, you may have a resource curse where the resources get extinct. Now, the future generation will have to pay. How are they going to pay? This is the biggest question, because what is supposed to have been done is for the oil money to be diversified.
The IMF report also says the current foreign exchange rate system between the official rate and the parallel market rate is unwarranted. It urges the central bank to tighten monetary policies and refrain from lending money to the government. For VOA News, I am Munis Reno in Juba.
Police in Cameroon have arrested four wildlife traffickers caught with huge quantities of elephant tusks and scales from pangolins. The traffickers, said to be operating across Africa, were planning to transport the scales and ivory to Asian countries through Nigeria. Muki Edwin Kinzika reports from Yaoundé.
Francis Duranna, the highest wildlife official in Cameroon's coastal city of Douala, says the traffickers were arrested following a tip-off from residents.
La délégation régionale de forêt, la faune du littoral, appuyée par l'AGA et par la division.
He says the police, supported by Cameroon's Ministry of Forestry and Wildlife and conservation groups, including the last great ape, LAGA, seized scales harvested from at least 3,000 pangolins and 300 elephant tusks plucked from 150 elephants that were illegally killed. He says it is an enormous loss to biodiversity, nature, and the economy. He says he is calling on people to adhere to the fight to protect wildlife and forest resources because only traffickers benefit. Police say the men are part of an organized ring operating in parks and protected areas on Cameroon's eastern and southern borders and possibly working with accomplices in the neighboring states. Central and Eastern Africa are hotspots for poaching and trafficking pangolins, an animal also known as the scalar anteater. Boniface Dongmo, a senior wildlife control official at the Ministry of Forestry and Wildlife, says Cameroon has been implementing its anti-poaching and trafficking laws, but says the practices are difficult to stop because of the huge demand for certain animal products in Asia.
That report by Muki Edwin Kinzeka brings us to the end of our show for this Wednesday, when I'll leave you with the song Poison by Daddy Lumba. That was a test from Eddie Lumba with his song Poison. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.